Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday, 13th of July. Sunny, hot, and humid. Today's high 90. The heat index heading for 98 this afternoon. Here are the current numbers. Not much change here this morning. Humidity at 76%. Now 75 in Kenosha, 76 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in four easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That beautiful music, of course, really needs no introduction. The title song to Rodgers and Hammerstein's final collaboration, The Sound of Music, one of the world's most beloved musicals. And it is opening tonight in a new production at the beautiful West Performing Arts Center in New Berlin, being performed this weekend and the next weekend by West Community Theater. And I'm very happy to have this opportunity on the morning show to make my initial acquaintance with this organization and with Judy Smith, who is at the helm and directing this production. And we also have the Baron von Trapp with us as well, a very talented performer by the name of Brian Madsen. And they are here in our studios to talk about The Sound of Music, again being performed this weekend and the next. Judy Smith, Brian Madsen, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank Good morning.
You. Good morning.
Great to have you here. And my thanks to WGTD's own Jim McClure, who is a part of the cast for The Sound of Music and alerted me to what's going on, to what a fine production this is. Very talented cast, a beautiful space, all kinds of reasons for people to seek out The Sound of Music. Judy Smith, first, I think it would be great for us to hear from you about the West Performing Arts Center. And from what I've seen from a couple of different video clips, it looks like an absolutely splendid space. Tell us more about it and the kind of things that go on there.
Awesome. Oh, I'd love to. Well, this was built in 2007 by the School District of New Berlin as an adjacent building to New Berlin West Middle and High School. At that time, they also built a field house in the back, which is also a premier space. State of the art, has a huge orchestra pit. In fact, the lowest I've ever seen. So people sitting in the front row will not, you know, usually that's the worst place to sit because you're so close to the pit and you're looking straight up. But it's actually was a huge consideration when they were doing musicals. In 2010, they realized that they hadn't been using it to its capacity. you know, so it sat dormant a lot.
This space.
And so in 2010, I came on board. I had opened the Sherilyn Wilson Center out in Brookfield and said, well, I would love to tackle this opportunity, but I also want to direct. I don't want to just be a rental or a scheduling person. So they gave me that opportunity. And we have, since then, the West Performing Arts Center does, I want to say we rent to over 60 different organizations.
Wow.
In a year, annually. And they always seem to come back because they love our space. They love my staff. In addition, West Performing Arts Center has two programs. And one is West Theater Arts Program, which is primarily, exclusively, New Berlin West Middle and High School. And we do four shows a year. The opportunity was, when I first took on the job, 95% of the kids that auditioned for that first show had never performed in a theatrical performance because they didn't have anything prior. So I made the middle and high school merge, the middle and high school show merge for our musicals. We have one musical a year. We do two high school plays. I try to do one drama and a comedy or a farce to mix up the, you know, give the kids an opportunity. But then we also do a children's playhouse for the middle school because it's very important. As an actress, a former actress, I knew how difficult it was to perform for children. So I'm making my middle school children actually have that opportunity. So that takes up, in addition to all the rentals and all the other opportunities that the school uses our auditorium, that takes up pretty much the whole school year. So this West Community Theater, we gave it a shot during the summer. So unfortunately that we don't have more of it, we only use the summer months to do one musical, and then we do a one-month workshop for youth between 5th grade and 12th grade to do a junior, so the MTI juniors, because we only really have 4 weeks to put on a show. And we've been doing this now for 6 years and growing, yes.
Wow. Tell us more about the space itself. You've already mentioned that it's an especially nice design in terms of the orchestra pit and so on.
Yes.
Tell us more about how it's laid out, how its size, and what makes it such a great space.
Well, 770 seats, and the sight line is phenomenal. And I've seen a lot of auditoriums. Sight line's phenomenal. But I would have to say, even from an acoustic standpoint, the engineers, the architects did a phenomenal job with making it live. I mean, the whole auditorium live, whether you're standing in front of the proscenium arch or even behind the proscenium arch, where we do have a lot of concerts. We have the orchestra shell. We have full fly capacity, so we do a lot of rigging. We have ADA, free parking, ticket booth, lovely lobby, and it's just a very nice... It's a very nice space. It doesn't feel overwhelming. You know, it's intimate, and yet there's 770 seats. So we are thrilled. And I'll tell you this, I push our space to its capacity because when I first came on, they said, yeah, we built this pit. We've never used it. So now we use it three times a year. And,
wow.
You know, taking off the pit cover takes... I don't know. I think they're down to 5 custodians, 2 hours, and they don't always relish it when I schedule it. But, you know, it's a really, really lovely space. And I think a lot of people who come back over and over again have their favorite seats because they know exactly where they want to sit for a play and then someplace a little further back for the musicals.
Interesting.
So, beautiful space.
So what has West Community Theater done before The Sound of Music? What other works have you mounted?
We have done, last year we did Disney's Beauty and the Beast, which was a huge undertaking because it's always expected to be, you know, this Disney spectacular with the costumes and the set.
And there was
magic, yes. You've got, that expectation. So that was huge for us. Wizard of Oz, which Brian, that's how we met. He was the Tin Man. We have done Oliver. We have done Nonsense. In fact, we've done 3 of the Nonsense. Nonsense 2, Nonsensations. We did the Suddenly Seymour Show. Can't even think of the name of it right now. Suddenly Seymour. Isn't this awful?
Is that Little Shop of Horrors?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, and then for our MTI Junior shows, you know, it's where we've got Annie Junior coming up, but we've done Willy Wonka Junior. We did Into the Woods last summer. So, yeah, the community theater, I would love, now, I'm an actress at heart, would love to do plays. And so I'm wondering if we can't branch out and find a little space during that busy season where we can do some dramas. But, it you know, these are the musicals that we've been staging during the summer.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
How would you characterize the people who populate your cast? Are many of them from New Berlin, or do you cast your net even farther than that?
All over. With Little Shop of Horrors, in fact, because Nonsense was a smaller group of us, primarily from New Berlin, but with Little Shop of Horrors, we had people coming all the way from Milwaukee, saying, "I want to be," and willing to drive the, you know, sometimes 40, 50 minutes for rehearsals nightly. Now they're coming from all over. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, I do have, and I'm thrilled about this, my New Berlin kids, you know, that some of the older kids in particular that will continue to come out for the summer and want to perform because they've had so much fun doing it during the school year. But, yeah, they come from all over, particularly the younger ones. Particularly, you know, so like the Von Trapp children, I want to say two of them are from New Berlin and the rest are all from someplace else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Brian Mattson, you're the Baron. Tell us about your initial connection with this group. I mean, do you live in or near New Berlin? And how did you even find out about West Community Theater?
At the time, I was living in Waukesha, actually, and my daughters, Brianna and Ella, which are now 12 and 8, respectively, wanted to come out for The Wizard of Oz a couple years ago, as Judy mentioned. That was one of the shows they did, and specifically my older daughter. And so I brought her out to auditions, and they were really excited. Brianna ended up, you know, she sings, she dances, she acts. And so she auditioned, and I was trying to encourage my youngest daughter to go ahead and sing also. And at the time, you know, she was 6 years old, still a little shy about it. And so she went up and she sang You Are My Sunshine, which was her go-to audition because that was one of those songs that she just happened to know. And but part of the deal was she said, well, Daddy, if, you know, I went and do it, then you have to go and audition too. You know, that was kind of the deal. And I said, well, you don't really need to do that. You did a great job. And she goes, Daddy, you promised. So I went up and I sang the Cowardly Lion song, actually, for the audition. And Judy liked it, and I ended up actually getting cast as the Tin Man. And had no intention of actually doing the show, and I don't regret it one bit. It was fantastically fun. I have loved working with Judy on that show and now with Sound of Music. And the crew, the technical director, music director, everybody is just so professional. It's probably one of my absolute favorite theaters to work with now. I mean, the space is fantastic, as she was saying. And the opportunity, especially for younger actors, younger actresses, specifically kids or people that are a little bit more inexperienced, for them to get an opportunity to actually work with this space and work with a full pit orchestra, which is what they do each summer, it doesn't happen very often in a lot of locations.
Right.
So that's tremendous experience. And they take the technical, modern sort of stance of everything between miking everybody, as Judy was saying, you know, being able to fly in different pieces. The backdrops that they get for all of the different set pieces are fantastic, and the work that they do on the sets are very professional. So for all the kids especially, they've been really excited in seeing all this kind of come together. There's a few of them that have never been in, you know, really professional style productions, and so for them the experience is just outstanding. I mean, each time they smiled. The organization usually does the New Berlin West parade, as we did again on the 4th of July. And so, you know, we hand out candy and we hand out cards and stuff to promote the show.
Dress in our costumes.
Dress in our costumes to go along. So, I mean, again, everybody has a really fun time, and it's always received incredibly well. And we usually end up having a couple of TV stations come out. We do some morning shows. And, again, that's a different experience, too, where a lot of the theaters in the area don't sort of have the promotional capability. And that comes down to a lot of Judy's planning and organization, and I think that's probably one of my favorite reasons for actually working with this place, is that she's so good at managing time, which, if anybody's been a part of theater, there's directors that sometimes bleed over, you know, the time limit that they were hoping for, or aren't quite as organized in knowing exactly what's going to be worked on each night. And she does just a tremendous job at making sure that everybody stays on pace and keeps things going and still makes it fun and very professional styled. So, yeah, it's absolutely one of my favorite spaces to work.
Nice. Tell us a little bit about your own background as a performer.
I have been part of theater since I was about 10 years old, so it's been a little over 30 years now. Started with sort of acting improv troupes and stuff and kids organizations. And then in my late teens, I actually traveled around the Midwest with a group called On Air. I was a study under the school of Marcel Marceau. And have a big background in learning miming, acting, body language, and reading people. I actually played professional poker for a while, and all those skills came in really handy. So that was always a nice thing. But then through my 20s, I ended up acting in various theaters around southeastern Wisconsin and Chicago. And then I took a bit of a hiatus until I was in my 30s. And my oldest daughter never knew that this is what I had done for so much of my life. And so at that point, she was 7 years old, and we had the opportunity to do It's a Wonderful Life at Sunset Playhouse. And so I got cast as George Bailey, and my oldest daughter at the time, as I said, was seven, and she got to be Zuzu. So that was her first main stage production, is she got to be my daughter. And so we had that really great moment at the end of the show, especially where she says, you know, teacher says, whenever a bell rings, you know, an angel gets its wings. And I got to always hold her, and I would, you know, tell her every night just how special it was to actually get to do this with her. Yeah. So I kind of came back into theater full time, did The Mousetrap, did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and several other musicals and whatnot. And then, as I said, I got to come out and do Wizard of Oz with the West Community Theater and couple other shows in between, and now here I'm back here again getting to play Captain Von Trapp with a great group of people again. It really is. I looked forward to it, so it's been a fantastic time.
Wow, wonderful. What did you mean exactly when you said full time? I mean, did you mean as in this is at least for a time how you made your living?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, my partner David Orgus and I actually owned DDI Films LLC. We actually owned a movie production company. We made our biggest release was Dare to Dream, the Alan Kulwicki story. For people who don't know, Alan Kulwicki was a race car driver actually from the West Dallas area. In fact, there's Alan Kulwicki Park. And he, towards the end of his career, he actually drove the Hooters car. And he was the last owner driver to actually win the cup and then died in a plane crash back in 92. And so we did a full-length feature film on him, and then we released it in all the Marcus theaters across the nation. And so it was, you know, a great experience to actually do a project that large for ourselves. We actually held the record for being the largest independent film to actually release in, you know, from Wisconsin that had ever happened. So it was fantastically fun. We ended up, you know, touring, doing autograph signings and promotional work. And that was kind of a new thing to be able to go on the national scene and really kind of get recognition for having done this work. And so, yeah, for a while, that's what we did is we made films. We did commercial work, done industrial films, voiceover work. I've just enjoyed it in all aspects. I mean, and so I stopped doing musicals for quite a while, just wasn't training my voice as much. But did a lot of voiceover work, and everybody said, you know, got to get back into the musicals. They're so much fun. And so doing Wizard of Oz a couple of years ago was the first time that I'd really done one in a while. So I've done this professionally. I've done it semi-professionally. I've done it just for fun. It just depends on the project at the time. Various characters really intrigue me. And so if I have the opportunity to do something, you know, that really makes it challenging, I'll jump at the chance to do it with most any theater.
Understandably.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Brian Mattson and Judy Smith. They are part of the production of The Sound of Music that is opening tonight in New Berlin at the West Performing Arts Center, and this weekend and next weekend as well. Rodgers and Hammerstein's beloved musical is going to be performed. Judy Smith, I wonder if you felt some of the same intimidation that I remember Doug Instanis at the Racine Theater Guild feeling at the prospect of doing The Sound of Music when you do a stage work that was meant for the stage originally, of course, but which everybody thinks of now primarily cinematically with that incredible 1965 film starring Julie Andrews. And I wonder if you thought very much about that in terms of doing this show, knowing that the typical person walks in the door with that splendid movie in their mind and with their expectations that what they're about to see is somehow going to kind of match up with that.
Right. And you know what? As an artistic director, that is one of the challenges for not only the audience, but also for the actors. So sometimes I'll say, well, we're going to do this, or this is the costume you're wearing. Well, that's not like the movie. Well, okay, we're not doing the movie. I would have to say, when you think about this show in particular, looking at the talent, I would have to say in many ways, you know, there's a lot of moments and obviously very good singing, that it's going to fulfill those folks' expectations. Our Maria is phenomenal. She is, and I use that word a lot with this show because am I right?
She has a fantastic voice.
She
it's been a pleasure to work with her.
Beautiful voice, beautiful voice. And her relationship with the kids, it's genuine. Hmm. I mean, I think that's how Susanna is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in fact, last year with Beauty and the Beast, that's how my Belle was. She was Belle. I mean, her persona just as a human. So,
well, and even Rose with Wizard of Oz. I mean,
and Rose with Wizard of Oz. I've been very fortunate with many of my actors. The children are adorable, and they get along now like siblings to the point where we have to say, "Okay, now quiet and settle down." When they're when they're not on stage. So I would say to anybody, I mean, from a staging standpoint, I have my favorite sets. Blair knows this, my construction manager. And I would have to say the set that we've created for the Von Trapp Mansion is probably my favorite. It's spectacular. I mean, it's breathtaking. And yet, not a lot of money. I mean, theaters don't have, you know, we're a community theater, so we don't have a big sponsor other than the school district. So we have to rely on those ticket sales. But I would have to say anybody that knows is going to just find it as endearing as the movie and appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Glad to hear that. I watched a news segment, television segment, where So Long Farewell was being sung, and we get a little glimpse of that gorgeous set.
Oh,
and
good.
I was very, very impressed with what things looked like.
And the kids do a really nice job with that song. I mean, they have fun doing it.
Yeah,
and
great.
It's really entertaining to watch them.
So, Brian Mattson, tell us a little bit about the character of Baron von Trapp and the kind of interesting emotional journey that the character takes and what it's like to take on a character like that, who is, in a sense, this complicated and at the outset, not particularly likable.
Yeah, absolutely. Captain von Trapp, originally the actual Captain von Trapp, was a submarine captain. And you learn that from, there was an actual Maria von Trapp who does write the background for the story of the entire musical. And so the captain, when you first meet him, he's sort of abrupt and kind of an authoritarian figure with the kids. And he runs everything in the family sort of like running a ship. You know, he uses a boatswain whistle. So he actually whistles for the kids. He actually has a signal for each of them so that they know when it's their turn to sort of come forward. And Maria kind of softens him up a little bit. At first, he's, again, very abrupt with her, because she's sort of changing the way things are done with the family. And the longer that time goes on, he kind of appreciates exactly who she is and that she's making the family a better place to be. Originally, he's actually engaged and set to be married to Elsa Schrader, who happens to be another millionaire, actually. Baron von Trapp is very well off with his mansion and how his life has gone. And so they're looking to actually join their fortunes and marry. And she's sort of supporting the new regime that's coming into Austria. The whole play is set in Austria. And it's at the time that the Germans are invading. And so the fact that she's sort of willing to go along with that really sets the wrong sort of feeling with the captain. And he doesn't really want to be a part of that. And so that's kind of what ends up splitting them up. And then he even more so appreciates who Maria is and what she stands for. Hmm. And so a love begins to develop between the two of them. And there is a great love song. It's actually one of my favorite in the show called Something Good. Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer sing it in a nice gazebo in the movie for anybody that remembers. And so Maria, which is played by Susanna, and myself get to sing that song together, which is, like I said, it's one of my favorite ones. And she does a fantastic job with it, makes it a fun scene. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's interesting you're singing it because, of course, it was not part of the original stage musical.
No,
it was
written
for the movie, but you've managed to incorporate it into the score somehow.
Judy actually had to get the rights for it,
it
so that
separate.
We were able to sing
it. It was separate from the – and there was a song in its place called Ordinary People.
Right. An Ordinary Couple. Yeah.
An Ordinary Couple, mm-hmm. Yep. And it just didn't – for me, it didn't – support the character's relationship, and this one does so very well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. And then again, the pit plays it wonderfully, so that it's just it's fantastic to sing with them.
Right.
And it's soft at times, and it's endearing, and the two characters really, you know, sing some harmony at times together, and it's just got that lovely moment that kind of shows how they come together.
Right. And do I remember that another thing that the Baron gets to sing is that lovely song Edelweiss.
Yes. I'm fortunate enough to actually sing Edelweiss at the end. That's during the concert series where the kids and the Von Trapp family and everything are singing. Again, sort of as a distraction from being pulled away. He was actually supposed to join the Navy again. And so they use that as a nice distraction to do the concert. We sing our initial song, and then I get to actually sing the solo on Edelweiss, which is, it's moving. So many people are familiar with Edelweiss. It's a fantastically famous song. And so I am very fortunate that I actually get to sing it. It's really a fun moment on the show.
Excellent. So Judy Smith, in the next couple of minutes that remain, just tell us about some of the things sort of visually and technically that you are especially proud of or pleased about in terms of this production. I think we've talked a lot about your marvelous cast and what a great job that they're doing, and a bit about the set as well. But what else do you want to tell us about that really sets this production apart?
Well, I when we first came to West Performing Arts Center, the sound for me was a challenge from a technical standpoint. We didn't have many microphones. Acoustically, you know, just from I came from an era, and this is going to age me, where we didn't have microphones. And so, you know, everything was projected. Yes. But now the expectation, I mean, as many senior residents that have come to our past productions before we actually invested in our sound system, you know, that was a lovely production. I couldn't hear. So we have... my technical director, Karen Krizak, and then we have Greg Klass for the first time joining us, have spent a lot of time and an investment into the sound, making sure that all the folks are mic'd. And so, you know, there's not going to be that situation, particularly when you have 30 people in the pit. Right. You know, you don't want them to overpower the actors singing, or even as they are up and under a scene from a dialogue scene. So from a sound standpoint, I think everybody's going to be very pleased that they get to not only witness it, but also hear everything that they're supposed to hear. The show itself, now you've done the show as well, so you know it's 2.5 hours. It's a true Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, I think it's our first musical actually written. So it's a longer show, but we try to keep it entertaining. We do very short scene changes, and yet we have set and, different backdrops and things that, we didn't simplify because we don't want, fast scene changes. We just incorporated a lot of different people. Some of the actors are actually helping being the running crew. Technically speaking, I think people are going to be very pleased that you know, that they're coming to see, I would say, a semi-professional production.
Oh, absolutely.
I think we do a very good job of that.
You get your money's worth.
Yeah, you do.
Being able to come out and see the show like that.
It sounds like it. Very good. So for people who want to seek out this production, which opens
tonight.
And runs next weekend as well, what do they do? How can they find out more information and get information specifically about tickets?
Okay, so you need to know that we have still a lot of good tickets for tonight and for the weekend. We are online. In fact, we're encouraging people to go online and buy the tickets because for two reasons. One of them is you don't have to stand in line, and we can start on time, even though we have two box office windows. But you also get to pick out your own seat. So we have that e-reserve system where you go online, you pick out the seats that you want, and then you can literally either print it out or show us your phone. And we'll seat you, and, you know, you can come early enough to instead of standing in a ticket line to buy refreshments or a t-shirt or a rose for your favorite actor or crew member. But everything is online, and we do it through New Berlin West School District site, which is NB, N is Nancy, B is in boy, excellence.org.
NBExcellence.org.
And then go under community. That's probably the fastest way. Just look under the community site, and you'll see West Performing Arts Center, and it'll take you right to wherever you want to look for. Auditions, upcoming shows, but certainly tickets and product.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Judy Smith is the director of this production, and Brian Mattson, Baron von Trapp. Great to meet both of you, and we wish you and everybody involved in this production of Sound of Music the very, very best. We hope lots of people will turn out to see this beloved and wonderful show. And thank you for being part of the morning show today here on WGTD.
Again,
thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
It's 8:42, and you're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two. For the next few minutes, we are going to be spending time talking about how we can keep the children in our lives safe online. A new book has been written called Parent Alert: How to Keep Your Kids Safe Online. And it is written by someone who is among the world's best experts on this important topic, Will Geddes. And perhaps you have heard his commentary on NBC, CNN, and Newsweek, and in many other platforms where he offers his thoughts on how we can keep our children, and for that matter, ourselves, safe online. This new book is published by DK. Will Geddes, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for the invite, Greg.
I'm impressed with this book. I really am. I happen not to be a parent, and yet this is a topic that is of concern to me. And I think even someone who is not a parent almost certainly has children in their lives in one way or another, whom they want to be keep safe, as safe as possible. But it also occurs to me as I read this book that this book is full of advice that is probably valuable for all of us, that just because someone is an adult does not mean that they are somehow blissfully safe as they work online. All of us need to be thinking about just about all of these issues.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Greg. And it's surprising, actually, because taking your point exactly, I've had a lot of adults who've seen advanced copies of the book, and they've seen the many chapters that we cover, and it is immense, as you know, from the copy you have in front of you, in terms of the just diversity of subjects that I've covered, from online shopping to extortion to violent content online, cyber stalking, grooming, healthy tech environments. I mean, the list is pretty long. And I've had a lot of adults who've turned around and said, you know what, there's a lot of things that I'm not actually doing that I should be doing, and ensuring that I'm keeping safe online as well, if not necessarily from the more child-specific concerning areas, but the areas of just being scammed online or having my computer infiltrated with some kind of ransomware or malware. So, you know, there's a lot that I think hopefully parents and children alike can take from this.
Absolutely. In the chapter that opens the book called Talking to Your Kids, I think you really make a great choice here in terms of laying down some basics, even before you get into any specifics related to high-tech and online dangers and so on. It's just about making sure that there are open lines of communication between parent and child. And I think one of the bits of advice that's really especially important is that parents need to try to express interest and be genuinely interested in whatever their children are doing, quite apart from when problems arise or there are potential dangers. Just being interested in this really important facet of their lives in a very friendly and kind of non-threatening way. I think that is really good advice that is probably valuable for a lot of parents who tend not to approach this whole topic in that way.
Well, that's very kind of you, Greg, and I'm glad it's coming over that way. It's an interesting aspect, this whole talking to children. I mean, I call it the three fundamental T's that every parent needs to have with their child, and that's trusting, teamwork, and talking. It's trusting the child because they will be using digital technology and going into the virtual world on their own, and it's hopefully trying to work with them to ensuring that they do it in a responsible way, that they engage best practice and they keep themselves safe. And that then follows through to the teamwork, that the child realizes that they can come and talk to the parent. And it's funny, I don't have children myself, and that comes as a surprise to many people, but my co-authors, Nadia and Kay, are both parents. Nadia's children are homeschooled, Kay's children go to a conventional school, and they've been critical in the whole sort of content and the way that this book is shaped, because although I don't have children, I've dealt with many cases that have involved kids and parents coming to me and saying, my child has been called out, found themselves in this very difficult situation. And I will deal with children in a very pragmatic sense. You know, not being a father, although I'm a godparent to many, many children, let me say, I will want to treat them like an adult, but do it in a very, a sort of collaborative sense of working with them and trying to find a solution. And the one thing I wanted to stress in this section on talking to kids, because most parents get very defensive when you say, here are some suggestions on how to talk to your children, because every parent will say, I know how to talk to my kids, is to say, look, the first and most important thing is to ensure that you do not judge them the moment they come to you. Because if the child feels that they're going to be punished by coming to you because they've got themselves caught out, and they could have innocently got themselves into a really difficult situation, if they think they're going to get punished, the phone's going to get, or the device is going to get taken out of their hands, they're going to leave it until the 11th hour. And that's not the best way to approach it. And I know that from dealing with many crises over the years. The soonest someone comes to you with the problem, the easier it is to potentially solve it right from the get-go. And there's an old friend of mine in law enforcement. He always had a great phrase, Greg, which was, a cock-up is far better than a cover-up.
Interesting. In this first chapter where you're talking about then when certain warning signs appear in a child, and it's a long list of potential warning signs that parents should certainly carefully examine, you also suggest that it's a great idea for parents to do what you call behavioral logging in order to really track some of these warning signs as they appear. Just say a word about what you mean and the kind of specific information that should be part of a parent's behavioral logging of their child's activity and behavior.
So one of the things, Greg, as you've seen, that we've put in the book is a number of elements of warning signs, which I think is really important for parents to be able to keep tabs on. Because if the child is not coming to them with a particular problem or a concern, again, you want to try and detect it as quickly as possible. And one of the things that you mentioned that we've included in the book is what we call behavioral logging, which is identifying the issues, obviously, right from the very early stages. Have I got you there, Greg?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, mate. You went very quiet there.
Yep. Nope.
In terms of identifying some of those key triggers, because one of those key indicators in isolation might just be the child behaving in a particular way. It doesn't necessarily mean it's indicative of a particular problem that they've got. So in behavioral logging, it's keeping a record without it seeming to be spying or monitoring the child, but just for you as a parent to be able to keep a monitor of certain behavioral activities so that if it becomes prolific or you see an exaggeration of that particular behavior, then you can intercept that problem hopefully easier and quicker at an earlier stage so that the child doesn't feel that you're simply talking to them every 5 seconds and saying, is there something wrong? Is there a problem? Because the child more than likely will turn around and say, no, I'm absolutely fine, Mom. I'm Dad. I'm fine. No problems at all. But if you see a number of these contributing factors showing, then that can give you the chance to maybe sit down and have that serious chat and say, I can tell something's wrong because you are behaving very strangely or you're acting in this very odd fashion, and you've got something to qualify it in your mind in a slightly better way.
Hmm. The next chapter is called Creating a Healthy Tech Environment. And, of course, this underscores the fact that we don't need to be removing technology from our children's lives, but we just need to be teaching them to use it in healthier fashion. I wonder if you would mind sharing with our listeners your 4 tips on how you can cut a child's time in front of a screen. I really like these a lot.
Well, thank you, Greg. Again, the first thing I would say, and I've probably got this in a different order to how I've written it in the book, so forgive me. The first thing I have to say is we as parents and as adults, we have to practice what we preach. It's very key that the child will look to us to how we're interacting with our devices. So if we spend our constant time checking it, doing emails, going on social media, then it's very difficult to try and set some precedent for the child that they do likewise. The second thing that I would generally advise is that you look at what I call tech-free zones in the house. Now, one of the things I definitely suggest that you try and avoid is the child having the device with them at night. There are statistics which are out there which are showing that, for example, 79% of young people will keep their mobile device nearby when they sleep. Now, I don't know whether you've experienced this, Greg, but I know I have, that if you wake up in the middle of the night for one reason or another, if you check your device, that immediately starts stimulating your brain cells because you're replying, you're responding, you're emotively reacting to whatever it might be that you've seen, and that is not going to be conducive to healthy sleep patterns. And for younger people, and particularly for children, that could have implications and repercussions into how they behave at school, they perform at school, and again, how their general disposition and health will be. The other issue is in having timeouts. And I know that Apple on the iOS system very recently did an update in their software and their operating software that can create means to put times out on the devices so that you as a parent can set those alarm clocks. But I think it's important also that because there's so much screen time, and the screen time can be divested across mobile devices, tablets, laptops, TV, gaming, there are so many screens. I mean, if you sit down and actually think, how many screens have I got in my own home, I think you'd be shocked. There's an awful lot of them. So it's about designating time that is used in the most productive sense possible. And a lot of kids will be using devices to do their homework, for example, and they're studying. Now, you can't obviously prevent them doing that, but when it comes to recreational, there can be certain measures that you can enforce either technology-wise because of the operating system, or as a parent, you say, look, you can spend 60 minutes on this device doing what you want to do, so it focuses the child to doing the most prioritized elements rather than just simply searching around the internet and on various websites and not really looking at anything in particular. But then you need to spend 60 minutes outside doing chores around the house, doing something productive that is not online. And I think that's important for their health as well.
Absolutely, a good mix. And you offer some other sort of more technologically based tips that can make a difference. And then, of course, from there, you start exploring some of the various specifics that are part of our lives online, including such sad realities as cyberbullying and cyber stalking and sexting and so on. One of the most interesting things that leapt out at me in the chapter about cyberbullying is when you lay out what you call the golden rule, don't feed the trolls. Briefly, what does that mean, don't feed the trolls?
Well, you know what, Greg, I've had in my professional life, I've had a lot of well-known celebrities, a few Hollywood A-listers who, when social media and Twitter really started coming into fashion, they were putting out these somewhat innocent comments, and then literally the keyboard warriors out there would just go for the throats. You know, they'd literally go for the jugular with horrible comments. And I've dealt with a real diversity of the widest spectrum of trolls, if you like, out there. And these are just individuals who get nothing more than pleasure from just being as offensive or horrendous or insulting as they possibly can. The thing I always suggest, and again, within my professional life, I teach also conflict management. And when you're dealing with someone who is highly aggressive or someone who's antagonistic, I call it the inflated balloon strategy. Now, if you think of a balloon, if you allow it to deflate, you know, all that hot air is coming out. The moment you say something back, you're just filling that balloon with more air again. So it will never really deflate. So you just got to allow them to just continue until it deflates and it's flat. And the same applies online. The trolls will be looking purely for a reaction. So what you don't want to do is to give them the oxygen to survive. Starve them of the oxygen by starving them of any kind of reaction or response. And I can pretty much assure that you give it enough time, be patient, and they simply go away.
Hmm. Your book includes lots of other advice, particularly on the kind of information that one should not share online or should not share too freely. And I even appreciate in the chapter on sexting a list you give for parents and other concerned adults on the acronyms that are used in sexting. And of course, without a resource like that, the typical parent has no idea what an innocent little set of numerals or letters in fact is conveying. I mean, that's the kind of thing that is of invaluable help to the typical parent.
Yes, I mean, there is this whole other language that is used online. And I would say, I hope I've covered as many of the most commonly used acronyms that are out there, but there are always going to be new ones. And that's why it's so important that parents keep as current as they possibly can. You know, there are things like the Urban Dictionary online in Google. So if you put in one of these acronyms, it will generally tell you pretty quickly. And I will readily confess, Greg, there have been a few of those acronyms which even I was baffled by. I had to go online to research and find out what they meant. But yeah, the whole sexting thing as well is a really worrying area. And it's amazing how many kids, but not just kids, but adults alike who are doing this. And I had a very well-known female celebrity who got herself in a really difficult spot, Greg, where, in fact, she'd taken some cheeky pictures. She'd sent them to the boyfriend at the time. They eventually split up. He, because he was a bit of a horrible character, said, well, look, unless you give me X many thousands of dollars, I'm going to put these things online. Well, you know, I managed to resolve the whole case. We got the pictures back, and we made him disappear. But, you know, I turned around to her, and I said, you know, well, that's going to be the last time you ever do that. And she said, Ashley, you know what, Will? I kind of enjoy doing it. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm going to get another call in a few months' time. Now, you know, there's a kind of controversial element in that chapter, Greg, you've probably seen, where I talk about safe practice doing sexting. And some people may say, look, this is irresponsible to actually tell people how to do sexting safely. But the problem is, it's much like most of the content out there online, we're not going to stop children doing it. We can tell them all the risks. And I go into great detail in the chapters, you know, about what the risks and implications are if they do send pictures or messages of that nature. But sometimes they're going to do it anyway, Greg, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. So the best we can do is to try and manage that process and keep them as safe as possible if they really are going to do it.
That's certainly the intent of your whole book, again titled Parent Alert, How to Keep Your Kids Safe Online. It's published by DK. Will Geddes, thank you so much for writing this interesting book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg.
We're approaching 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Monday, Dr. Art Sear joins us, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, for his monthly visit to the program. On Tuesday, we step back into the world of Gray Gardens with Jerry Torre, author of a memoir called The Marble Faun of